Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. Today, we have something of a special edition for you. Back at the start of the year, UBS convened thousands of attendees, investors and companies for its annual flagship Greater China Conference, the 24th edition of which happened in Shanghai in January. We're alighting on just one of the amazing conversations that happened at the conference and on the margins in this week's programme. We're happy to bring you what was one of the undisputed highlights from this year's edition. Delegates were treated to an absolutely compelling, fascinating keynote luncheon address on the theme Artificial Intelligence, the Path Forward. Delivering the speech, well, the GCC was treated to no less a legend of the scene than Professor Geoffrey Hinton, the so-called godfather of AI. Hinton is Emeritus Professor at the University of Toronto, a former engineering fellow at Google, and Turing Award laureate for his remarkable work on neural networks. As well as Hinton, the keynote featured a former researcher in the great man's lab in Toronto, Dekai, himself now a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at HKUST, the Hong Kong University of Science and Tech. Dekai is also director of the AI ethics think tank, the Future Society. What a treat in store for you today, then. We're going to hear from both of these luminaries on this week's edition. We start with the godfather of AI himself, Professor Geoffrey Hinton. Here he is.
I'm going to start by talking about the issue of whether these large language models, like GPT-4, really understand what they're saying. So many people have said that they're just doing autocomplete, they're just predicting the next word, they don't really understand what they're saying. And I think those people have in mind that you can do autocomplete not very well by just storing sequences of words and noticing when you've got the first part of a sequence. Like in English, if you see fish and, it's quite likely the word chips comes next. That's a very simple form of autocomplete, and it's not at all what these large language models are doing. What we've discovered really with large language models is that if you force a system to predict the next word really well, in order to do that, it has to understand what the previous words mean. It has to understand what you're saying to make that prediction. And that's a major discovery that lies behind these chatbots. Now, another reason why people think they may not understand is they do a lot of confabulation. They just make things up. But the fact is that people just make things up all the time. If you look at the testimony that John Dean gave at the Watergate inquiry, he actually made up lots of stuff, even though he was trying to tell the truth. And we know that because there were tapes of what was actually said. And this happens all the time in human memory. So the fact that chatbots confabulate actually just shows they're more like us, not less like us. So if you really want to know if they understand like we do, you need a model of how we understand. And I think most people have forgotten that these large language models emerged out of smaller neural net language models that go all the way back to 1985. And those initial neural net language models, they were using very small data sets, but they were just trying to predict the next word. And they were designed as a model of how the brain understands. So the fact is, we don't have a better model of how we understand than these neural nets. Those early language models using neural nets didn't have attention. And once attention was added to neural nets, then they worked really well. And so we have things now like GPT-4. And what you have to understand is that GPT-4 really does understand what it's saying. And it probably understands in a very similar way to we do. So early on in AI, people thought that understanding meant having an internal symbolic expression that you could operate on with symbolic rules. And what's happening in these large language models is understanding consists of taking symbols for fragments of words and fleshing out those symbols with big vectors of features that capture the syntax and semantics of those word fragments. But that seems very like what we do too. So to summarize that, I think they're understanding, and they're understanding in much the same way as we do. And the earlier AI models of what understanding was, namely generating internal symbolic expressions, were actually not good models of how we understand. In particular, they're very good at understanding things like analogies that symbolic AI was never very good at. So things like GPT-4 can now understand analogies that many people have difficulties understanding. So for example, if I ask you, why is a compost heap like an atom bomb? GPT-4 understands that, and most people don't. So the second issue I wanted to talk about was what the benefits will be from these large models. And I think there's going to be tremendous benefits. And it's because of these enormous benefits that there's no chance of stopping the development of these models. Perhaps the most obvious area is in medicine, where in North America alone, about 200,000 people a year die because of bad medical diagnoses. And AI should be able to get rid of most of that. An AI doctor will be able to use all the information about the patient, the genome, the test results, even handwritten notes that the doctor made, and be able to use a model that was trained on millions of patients. It's already comparable with doctors at medical diagnosis, and quite soon it'll be much better. It'll also be much better at reading medical images. I made a prediction in 2016 that by 2021 it would already be much better, and I was wrong about that, so I'm a bit more cautious about predictions. It's going to be another 5 years or so. But I don't think there's much doubt that in the end it'll be much better than radiologists at reading medical scans. Another thing that these AI models are going to be good for is designing drugs and designing new nanomaterials for things like solar panels. There's one particular application that's probably going to be the most important, which is chatbots that act as personal assistants. So these are going to take all the drudgery out of work. And I'm hoping that we can move towards very intelligent personal assistants that don't have goals of their own. They only have goals that we give them. And so they act like an extremely intelligent executive assistant to a rather dumb CEO. Maybe the CEO was the son of the former CEO or something. But with a very intelligent personal assistant who aims to help the CEO, that can be a much more effective CEO. And that's the direction I hope we're headed. Of course, there's an alternative possibility, which is that these things develop goals of their own and decide they don't need us. My current belief is that sometime between the next 5 and 20 years, there's about a 50% chance that we'll get AGI and then soon after that, super intelligent systems that are much more intelligent than us. I think it's probably coming in less than 20 years, or at least a chance of a half of coming in less than 20 years. And the scary thing is, we don't really know how to make sure those systems don't develop goals of their own that don't agree with our goals. As soon as you give them the ability to create their own sub-goals, you realize bad things can happen. Like, for example, if you ask them to get rid of climate change, they might realize the best way to do that is just to get rid of people. That wouldn't be fortunate. That's called the alignment problem. And I've been encouraging for the last year or so, I've been encouraging smart young researchers in AI to work on that problem, because I think it's a crucial problem. We need to solve it before these things get smarter than us. There are many other possible bad effects of these AGIs, or things that aren't even AGIs. So lethal autonomous weapons are an obvious bad thing. And lethal autonomous weapons will be developed, and many of them will be developed by bad actors. Who you think is a bad actor depends on where you are, but there will be bad actors who develop these things. There will also be cyber criminals who develop these things. And one particular thing I've got very scared about recently is open source large models. So if you take these foundation models, the biggest of these large language models, particularly multimodal ones, if you open source them, it's very easy for people to fine-tune them. And even though it may take $100 million to train one of these models, you can fine-tune it for only a few million dollars to be very good at, for example, phishing, so that cybercrime will be much easier. And you don't need to be that skilled to do the fine-tuning. So that's a big worry. I'm glad to see that countries like Britain are putting aside money so they can try fine-tuning open source models to see how easy it is to turn them into cyber criminals. There are many other problems, like replacing jobs. One problem that is already a big problem, but I'm not so scared about, is discrimination and bias, because I think we can measure those much better in these big systems. And because we can measure them, we can at least make AI systems less biased than the systems they're replacing. They won't be unbiased, but they could be less biased. There's many other dangers I could talk about, but the last one I want to talk about is a very urgent danger this year, and it's to do with generative AI being able to produce very convincing fake videos to influence elections. That's already going on. It's quite disheartening that very recently Mark Zuckerberg removed the prohibition on Facebook for advertising that says that Biden lost the last election. It's clear what happens when doing the politically correct thing and making profits conflict. So I'm very worried about how fake videos are going to corrupt elections. So to summarize, I think they really do understand. I think there's a chance they'll make terrific personal assistants. There will be wonderful things, but there's also a chance those will go rogue. I think there'll be many big benefits, like in medicine, but I think there's some very scary things. And the most immediate scary thing is fake videos corrupting elections. And I don't think there'll be legislation against that in the United States, because one of the political parties has pinned its hope on exactly that.
Professor Geoffrey Hinton. Well, next up, the lucky GCC delegates heard from Dakai, professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at HKUST, and another of the very finest minds active in this field today. Let's hear what he had to say.
In the wake of the OpenAI drama, AI safety is widely being framed as a struggle between AI accelerationists who advocate for faster progress and AI decelerationists who want to pump the brakes on the existential risks that AI poses for humanity. I think this naive speed versus safety narrative, pitting techno-utopians against doomers, is dangerous because it harms our ability to navigate the promise and the perils of our new AI era. I've been working for 40 years in AI research in natural language processing and related fields, a little bit less than my esteemed colleague, Geoff Hinton. In that time, I pioneered a series of machine learning advances that let me build the world's first large-scale online language translator, which quickly spawned the likes of Baidu Translate, Google Translate, Microsoft Translate, and so on. Now, over 30 years ago, when I was recruited to be one of the founding professors to build Hong Kong's massively ambitious first research university, what we know today as HKUST, I'd just written one of the first PhD theses at Berkeley on probabilistic machines that learn to understand languages. And then I spent my postdoc playing with what we now call deep learning in Geoff Hinton's lab in Toronto 30 years ago. I decided upon arriving in Hong Kong to get machines to learn how to translate. Here is something amusing from the 1990s. You would be hard-pressed to find folks who'd argue against developing translation AIs. This was, in fact, several years before Google built a copy for Google and Yahoo, etc. And what I was saying here was that at that time, people were saying, why are you working on Chinese and English translation? And I was pointing out, even though today only 2% of the internet is in Chinese, bear in mind this is in the 1990s, that is going to change. Guess what? That has changed. The Chinese internet is enormous. And English is the world's most widely spoken language. Chinese is the world's most widely natively spoken language. And so once you get to the 2020s, things have changed a lot. Now, how have things evolved? First of all, nobody would argue that developing translation AIs is a bad idea. In fact, at a quiet retreat a few months ago, a handful of us in the AI space, including OpenAI co-founder and chief scientist Ilya Sutskever, that we were just talking about, as well as OpenAI CTO, and a very brief interim CEO, Mira Murati, they openly acknowledged the immense good that AI can do, but there is also a dark side. For the past decade, I've given hundreds of public talks and lectures on AI ethics. I was an inaugural member of Google's externally advisory council on AI ethics, and I serve on the board of the think tank, the Future Society, which is helping draft the EU's forthcoming AI Act. What drove me to act almost 10 years ago was seeing many of the same techniques invented for beneficial purposes by our natural language processing and machine learning community, instead being deployed in profitable ways that cause severely harmful unintended consequences. Many of you have probably heard about a company called Cambridge Analytica. This company worked to use AI to gather and spread information on a massive scale so as to influence the outcome of voting in numerous countries, including the US and the UK. What eventually emerged is that Cambridge Analytica was backed by a reclusive, brilliant hedge fund billionaire named Robert Mercer. But before he took the Wall Street offer 20-some years earlier that made him a billionaire, Mercer was a computer scientist at IBM Watson, working on human language technology or natural language processing, and specifically on getting machines to learn to translate between English and French. The Association for Computational Linguistics is the main international organization for natural language processing, and a dozen years ago, they decided to establish an honor called the ACL Fellows. In its history, over a half century, the field had never had anything like Nobel or Fields or Fellow honors, and to catch up with that, they decided that on this one-shot historic occasion, they would name 17 founding fellows. And for the breakthroughs that led to AIs like Google Translator, Baidu Translator, Microsoft Translate, the two founding fellows they named were Mercer and me, which is why I've been thinking a lot in the last dozen years about the consequences of the work we do developing artificial intelligence and machine learning. Those consequences are enormous. Because unlike translation AIs, media AIs that power social media and recommendation engines and search engines have been dangerously amplifying polarization and bias and misinformation. They do so through their massive power to decide what to show or what to not show in your social media feeds, in your video or online shopping recommendations, and in your web searches. AIs that propagate inaccurate or even worse, incomplete information are an existential risk to the functioning of societies. AIs are encouraging the hundreds of cognitive biases that evolution has left us all unconsciously full of. And that is both escalating societal polarization domestically in many countries, causing increasing social divisiveness in many countries, as well as escalating societal polarization internationally, risking dangerous geopolitical conflicts. People worry about the threat of AGI destroying humanity. It's a great sci-fi narrative, very entertaining, highly gripping, and fear-mongering. But if we allow media AIs to keep polarizing humanity, AGIs will never get the chance to destroy humanity because humanity will destroy humanity first. Now, AIs are manipulating humanity through our Achilles heel, and they're about to wield even more unimaginably vast power to manipulate our unconscious, which large language models like ChatGPT have barely hinted at. The Oppenheimer moment is real. But here's another naive dichotomy that propagates a false dichotomy. The AI Act that's just last month been passed by the European Union reacts by attempting to ban AIs from manipulating humans. Sounds good, but guess what? Everything is a manipulation. But now, we humans, we love our mythology that we have free will, autonomy, sovereignty, agency. But the fact is, even the act of having a conversation is a manipulation of the other participant. When you speak, that speaking is a manipulation. Education is a manipulation. Doing any awareness raising is a manipulation. Choosing how to answer a question is a manipulation. Choosing what to show a human or what to not show a human is a manipulation. Doing nothing sounds good, but it is not a real option. Even for an AI, merely to give a user matching results for their query is a decision to either increase or reinforce their confirmation bias, or to open their perspective to things that they did not necessarily believe or want to know. We humans are full of hundreds of cognitive biases that operate largely unconsciously. Yet, we want AI governance to force AIs to be less biased than humans are. Well, guess what? We cannot both ask AIs not to manipulate us unconsciously and at the same time ask AIs to be better, less biased than we humans are. The real question that everybody is avoiding, because it makes us so uncomfortable, is how much do we want AIs to manipulate us and how? And what are the criteria? AI presents humanity and society with many dangers we haven't thought through and we are ill prepared for. Dangers that concern folks like the former OpenAI board members, including Helen Toner and Tasha McCauley, as well as tens of thousands of colleagues who signed a March open letter last year calling for a pause on giant AI experiments drafted by MIT's Future of Life Institute. And one of the key movements in those circles is something called AI alignment, which focuses on developing methods to align AIs with the goals of humanity. Ilya Sutskever and OpenAI head of alignment research, Jan Leike, have been co-leading a recently announced super alignment research program that's trying to grapple with how to align artificial superintelligence systems that are much smarter than humans. But yet again, there's an elephant in the room. There's a problem that we're not looking at. Alignment to what kind of human goals? Philosophers and politicians and populations have wrestled since the dawn of humanity with all the thorny trade-offs between different goals. Short-term instant gratification, long-term happiness, avoidance of extinction, individual liberties, collective good. What about bounds on economic inequality? What about equal opportunity, degree of governance, free speech, safety from harmful speech, the allowable degree of manipulation or persuasion or influence, tolerance of diversity, permissible recklessness, rights versus responsibilities? There's no universal consensus worldwide on such goals, let alone on even more triggering issues in various countries, like, say, gun rights in the U.S. or reproductive rights or geopolitical conflicts. In fact, the OpenAI saga amply demonstrates how impossible it is to align goals even among a tiny handful of OpenAI leaders. How on earth can AI be aligned with all of humanity's goals? We AI researchers are the proverbial man with a hammer, strongly tempted to frame everything in terms of maximizing an objective function or a KPI. To get safe AI, we just need to maximize the alignment between AI and humanity's goals. Now, if only we could just define a neat objective function that measures the degree of alignment with all of humanity's goals, that would solve the problem. But what we in the rationalist AI research community too often overlook are the existential risks that arise from the way that AI interacts with the complex dynamics of humanity's messy psychological and social and cultural and political and emotional factors, which are not cleanly packaged into some simple mathematical function we can simply align AI to. As I argued in a New York Times essay last month, AI companies, AI researchers, AI regulators, and our human populations need to urgently accelerate tackling how AIs should be operating in the face of unresolved, age-old trade-offs between conflicting goals, and to accelerate developing the kind of AIs that can help with this. Meanwhile, we need to decelerate deployment of AIs that are exacerbating socio-political instability. Instead, we need to accelerate development of AIs that help to de-escalate instead of escalating dangerous levels of polarization. And we need to stop sweeping these real challenges under the rug through these oversimplistically misframed narratives of AI accelerationism versus decelerationism. Culture matters. AIs are now an everyday part of society, a fact which will come to be more pronounced than most folks ever envisioned. It is already too late for us to start realizing this. So let's let a boardroom conflict at OpenAI be our opportunity. It's possible for us to dream fast, big, and to slow misunderstanding.
That was Dikai, and before that, Professor Geoffrey Hinton. And that brings us to the end of this special edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle Radio. You can listen again as ever at monocle.com. That's where you can join the club and subscribe to the magazine. You can also follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can discover more and find out how UBS can help you by heading to ubs.com. That's where you can explore all the events in the bank's global calendar, including the annual Greater China Conference. This is The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.